From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Advocates for school vouchers recently touted the results of a research study from North Carolina State University. We'll chat with the researchers themselves to get their take on the findings. You'll hear highlights from the legislative debate over a proposal to reduce the existing cap on North Carolina's income tax. The new chairman of the UNC Board of Governors outlines his priorities for the group that sets policy for the statewide university system. And we'll discuss the impact of a new state audit. It details millions of dollars of waste within the agency that oversees alcohol sales in North Carolina. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
Hundreds of thousands of North Carolina kids are back in school. Now, for them, of course, it means back to homework, back to tests, but new friends and a whole lot of other interesting things. For dad and mom, this time of year means paying off the credit card bill for back-to-school supplies, and the same goes for many teachers as well. So how big will those credit card bills be when it comes to paying for the supplies? And is it really necessary to spend a bundle at the store at this time of year? Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies, and he has written several really interesting pieces about the history of school supplies and how much we spend. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I know I'm probably dating myself as being old here, but in my day, all mom and dad had to do was every year they bought me a new lunchbox, usually with the logo of some popular TV show on it. They bought me a few pencils. They bought me a notebook and a new pair of shoes, and that was it. It's much different today.
Well, it certainly is, because parents are confronted with the prospect of having large lists of items to buy and items that are requested by schools and teachers for students to bring on the first day of school.
How did that all come about?
Well, in the late 80s, we started seeing schools provide these supply lists to students and to parents via report cards being sent to mail or during orientation or open houses. So it slowly built from a couple schools doing it in the late 80s to, by the early to mid 90s, it really catching on, and lots of schools started ramping up these supply lists. And of course, once the internet exploded, the supply list went online, and stores started picking up the list, making copies, and putting them in the lobby. So it did not take long for these supply lists and for parents to feel the obligation to use the supply lists to supply their kids' teachers with any number of items.
Essentially, it became a big, important deal to schools and also to retailers to get their product onto the supply list, because then everyone kind of assumed, I got to go get all these things.
Well, you said it, because, you know, when we went to school, it was lunchbox, pair of shoes, maybe a trap keeper, some kind of cool thing like that that you take. But if a retailer starts putting things on the list and parents start feel obligated to buy those things, then the retailer makes more money. So, of course, they're going to encourage these supply lists to be distributed to parents and make it as easy as possible for them to access them. And today, they've made it even easier. You can go online, click the name of the school. They have all the items already in a box that you just pay for, and that box is sent to the school.
Absolutely fascinating how this is really developed. You've written a really interesting piece about this, by the way. It's available at johnlock.org. So today, Terry, I mean, you have kids in school, for example, and you're a former teacher yourself. How much money are we talking about that families, that moms and dads, grandmas and grandpas are spending every year?
Well, you have to look at the different categories of expenditure. So just for things like school supplies, we're looking at about $125. We're not looking at a necessarily a lot of money per kid for supplies, But supplies is just one of the many things that a parent has to buy their child. They obviously want to buy them clothes, new pair of shoes, lunch boxes, backpacks, and all the other items can really add up to hundreds of dollars in back-to-school shopping.
Per child. And per if child. You're a family that has multiple kids, suddenly this is really a lot of money.
It becomes a major investment. It becomes sort of a Christmas time activity where right. you're spending hundreds of dollars on your kids. But in this case, they're not happy about what you're spending the money on, unlike Christmas. So this really adds up for parents, especially those that have large families.
Terry, teachers also get in on the back-to-school supply buying game here. And we hear lots of media stories about how teachers are spending their own money to make sure that they have supplies and they have decorations and curriculum materials, et cetera, in their classrooms. Is that really necessary in North Carolina? Is there not enough money that is going to classrooms to have them ready for those kids?
Well, teachers spend their money on lots of different things. And the average, from we can glean several studies, is about $500 the average teacher will spend in back to school throughout the school year in various sort of items. Now, I'd like to break this down to three different items. The first is decor. These are borders. These are interesting things, posters that a teacher may put up in the classroom. In fact, my wife was actually cutting her border last night for our classroom, so I see this firsthand. The second thing is school supplies for kids, paper, pencils, and those sorts of things. The third category is professional development and curricula that a teacher can buy as labor-saving devices, basically. And rather than coming up with the lessons on their own, they can buy lessons online or obtain professional development materials, books on how to teach and different strategies you can use in the classroom. Now, I tend to think that the third category is there's plenty of materials online, and I think teachers should be expected to be able to buy those things out of pocket. I think every professional buys things that helps them do their job better and doesn't expect someone else to pay for those things. So it's really that second category I worry about the most, buying supplies for kids. I think that teachers probably have a good case that there's a reasonable expectation that the schools and the parents provide things like notebooks, papers, pencils, and maybe folders to keep everything organized.
One angle on this story that, again, is reported on a lot around this time of year is how much money is being spent actually in that is appropriated from the State General Assembly to schools for those items. Is enough being appropriated, or is it now a requirement that in order to have your room ready, that a teacher has to go spend their own money?
Well, this gets tricky because the state sets aside around $60 or $70 million for textbooks, and there are various other state monies that go to supplies. Not only that, there's local money and there's federal money that's also used for supplies. So we're really talking about, if you look at statewide, hundreds of millions of dollars for supplies and materials being spent by schools. But the issue here is that if schools want more supplies and need more money for supplies, there are very few restrictions for them to be able to use money from other categories and move it to their supply budget. It's the one thing that a lot of people don't want to talk about. They argue that the state is forcing them to spend money in certain ways when the state actually gives them a great deal of flexibility. So if I was in charge of a school district and I saw that I had insufficient supplies – and I know that supplies are necessary and needed and textbooks are necessary. I can take the money from any number of different categories and move it into that category for books and supplies.
Terry, there is something known as the annual workplace survey in North Carolina. And you were posting some of the interesting results where teachers are responding to questions about how much is appropriated to schools and what they have to use in their classrooms. What do they say about this question of supplies and being ready?
Well, about 8 out of 10 teachers say that they agree or disagree that they have sufficient materials and technology to be successful in their classroom. And I think that this is a survey that's often overlooked when we talk about how teachers feel about various things in the classroom. This is the 2018 Teacher Working Conditions Survey that asked teachers about any number of different issues, including professional development, parental involvement, administrators, but it also asked them about facilities and supplies. And so teachers are reporting that they have what they need. Now, there's about 20% of teachers that say that they don't. But the idea that every teacher is mad and every teacher feels like they don't have what they need to be successful in the classroom is clearly contradicted by these survey results, a survey that encompasses almost every teacher in the state.
Well, it is fascinating, the whole subject of back-to-school supply lists and how much is spent. And Terry Stoops has been writing about this. You can read all of his pieces on this subject at johnlock.org. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at carolinajournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at carolinajournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. School choice supporters have touted a recent North Carolina State University study assessing the impact of the state's Opportunity Scholarship Program. We've featured some of those supporters on this program. Now we chat with two of the researchers themselves. Stephen Porter is a professor and Anna Igalite, an assistant professor in NC State's Department of Educational Leadership, Policy, and Human Development. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us on.
So people who've listened to this show have heard some about this report. When you look at everything that you put together on the assessment of how this affected student achievement, what's the main takeaway that you hope people in North Carolina will know about it?
Well, Mitch, it's very important to keep in mind that we consider this a pilot study. This is certainly not the definitive word on the program. We were able to recruit 698 students, and that was a big lift to do that. We had to administer an assessment to them. Those were students in private and public schools, and conduct a matching analysis to ascertain the program's impact. So we're very pleased that we've been able to do that and give some sort of a snapshot into student performance in the program, but it's important to keep in mind we cannot speak about average student performance for kids getting these scholarships.
Not a definitive study then.
Not at all, yeah.
School choice supporters have looked at this, especially the lines in there talking about the positive, large, statistically significant impact for the students who were participating in this. They've said, hey, this is a sign that the voucher program is working well. Are they right? And if they're not completely right, what caveats or other qualifications should they keep in mind?
Well, we can say that the subsample, the 698 students that made it into our analysis, and it's actually a smaller number that made it into the final model that has all of the control variables that are so important to account for, certainly we can say with some degree of confidence that they're performing higher than they otherwise would have in math and in language skills. But the thing to keep in mind is that we cannot say that the program overall is effective because we just don't have enough information yet. That's something we would love to be able to do. It would take a larger sample, and it would take some changes to how the program's currently designed. So it's not something that lends itself to evaluation right now. We thought it was important to do the work so that we could demonstrate these are the barriers in place right now. If you're serious about seeing an evaluation, this is what needs to be overcome.
Yeah, I would say the other caveat is that, unfortunately, we don't know enough about all the private schools in the state to say exactly what was going on with the private schools that agreed to allow us to test our students. I think a reasonable guess would be that they are relatively well functioning, which is why they wouldn't mind us coming in and testing their students. So if I had to put a caveat on the results, it would be it's probably more the effect of giving a kid a voucher and letting them transfer to a well functioning private school as opposed to any private school in the state.
So questions involving both the sample of the students but also the sample of the schools involved.
Yes.
Exactly.
I think probably the sample of the schools is the bigger factor than the sample of students.
And that leads into the next question, and that is there have been some people who monitor this situation, especially those who are not as big a fans of school choice, who have raised questions about the study itself and said, you know, this isn't telling us what the school choice supporters think it's telling us. Did they have legitimate concerns about the way this was conducted?
So I think the context matters here. That where there was previously a knowledge vacuum, we now have some glimmer of information about what's going on. So we see that as being of value. But yes, they are right to have concerns because we still don't know enough about the students, the impact of the program on students' academic outcomes.
I also think there's some confusion about self-selection. There's really two levels here. The first is schools on both the public and private side had to select to participate, and then individual students within those schools had to agree, or their parents had to agree to be tested. And so when I read some of the commentary, it seems as if people are confusing those two issues. We have a pretty rich variety of variables, most importantly, the prior year EOG score. My gut feeling is that selection at the student level is not really what's driving our results. Instead, it's I think they do have a point when they say that our sample of schools on both the public and private school side are not completely representative of schools in the state. But that's typical in these kinds of studies. In essence, it's difficult to achieve perfect internal and external validity. And so, as is often the case, researchers focus on strong internal validity at the expense of external validity.
You know, there's something to be said about letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. We have acknowledged and been transparent about all the limitations of what we can say, but we're still proud that we've done the work so that we can say, all right, we know one more thing now than we did previously. What can we do better? And so we've started a conversation.
That is the voice of Anna Egalite. You also heard from Stephen Porter there with NC State University's Department of Educational Leadership, Policy, and Human Development. So you have this study, which actually isn't even the first study. It's one of several that you've done related to the Opportunity Scholarship Program. Your answers suggest to me that there is much more work that can and should be done on this. What are the types of things that you would like to see moving forward studying this program?
So the gold standard evaluation that we would like to do requires for the program to be oversubscribed. If there is a situation in which more students apply than vouchers are offered, it lends itself very nicely to a very rigorous gold standard study where we could compare students and make causal claims about whether their achievement went up or went down and actually know definitively what the impact was. So that idea of a participation cap is perhaps unpopular, but it's something that should be put on the table if we are serious about evaluating the program.
And by saying oversubscribe, what you mean is that some people would end up getting the voucher, others wouldn't, and you could compare those actual people rather than try to find similar students in public schools.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and the way the program is currently structured, pretty much anyone who applies and follows through all the steps will receive the voucher. So no one is actually turned away, which is different from many other voucher programs in the country.
How important is it from the vantage point of researchers like yourselves that we get some sort of good, legitimate look at how this is working beyond the pilot that shows some potential good signs for this program? How important is it to move on and not just say, okay, this is enough, we know it works?
I mean, there's about over 7,000 students using these vouchers at the moment, and it's a $28 million program that's entering its fifth year of operation, and we still know very little. We've attempted to bridge that gap, provide some insight into the program through the reports that are all posted on our website at NC State. But for such a large program, I think that there is a public policy interest in knowing more about its impact.
In the time that we have left, the General Assembly in our state has put forward a long-term commitment to this program. There's more funding going out several more years now. As that moves forward, from a research perspective, is it going to be important for them to have some good, solid study piece in place rather than just rely on researchers who were interested in it and wanted to do something, should they build something specifically into the law?
It depends on their goals. If their goal is to expand choice for the sake of choice, and for some people that is sufficient, then they have met that goal. The program has grown every year it's been in operation. If their goal is to expand quality choices, quality seats in which students are learning more as a result of participating in the program, then we have no idea if we're meeting that goal. The program is not set up to be evaluated, and that requires some changes if it's going to happen.
No, I would agree.
Okay, very good. Once again, we are speaking to Stephen Porter, who is a professor, and Anna Egalite, who is an assistant professor in NC State's Department of Educational Leadership, Policy, and Human Development. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Should North Carolina lower the cap on its income tax rate from 10% to 7%? Republican State Representative Jason Sane thinks so.
The bill would help safeguard the substantial tax relief provided in recent years to protect taxpayers from harmful tax increases in the future. Senate Bill 75 establishes a reasonable limitation of taxes on income, the most harmful form of taxation, and puts the state in a position to adopt protections against tax hikes and overspending in the future.
Among those who say no, Democratic Representatives Pricey Harrison and Darren Jackson.
I think that there are a number of reasons why this is a bad idea. One is regressive. Two, we're locking in future legislators from the ability to react to financial crises. We haven't hit a recession since we have been cutting the income taxes, but we may get another recession. I'd heard that we were looking at somewhat of a structural deficit in future years as a result of the current income tax cuts. We may have another horrible disaster or two, the hurricanes, fires, floods, And I think that the thought of limiting our ability to temporarily raise an income tax so that we can deal with a significant shortfall of funding for our state's needs is a really bad idea.
Washington, D.C. is running about a $1 trillion a year deficit. And at some point, they are going to have to stop that, I think. I think we would all agree that that would be a good thing if they would stop that on both sides of the aisle. Well, when they do, there's several things they could do. They could raise taxes. They could cut spending. They could shift things down to the state to pay for. And when that day undoubtedly comes, we're going to have to decide how we want to deal with that. And this is going to take one of our options off the table.
Republican Nelson Dollar responds to the critics.
I am quite confident that the room between what the rate is going to be in 2019 and where this cap is more than sufficient to satisfy any of the rating houses, as well as to satisfy any of the needs that we may have in the future as far as our recurring appropriations need to be. And I would also point out to the body that we have currently in our rainy day fund $2 billion. This is not like it was 7-8 years ago when there was maybe $200 million at most. We have $2 billion. And frankly, if you look at the other reserves that we have in a variety of places, it's actually over $3 billion that we have. We are quite in good shape in this state, and we've managed well, and this cap is quite reasonable in terms of this bill. And I'm sure that the citizens of this state will overwhelmingly support this, and ultimately, again, it will be their decision.
Voters will decide on the income tax cap in November. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The UNC Board of Governors has a new chairman, one who wants to inject more business practices into the board. Harry Smith recently conducted his first meeting as chairman.
We're looking at, you know, where we want to go as a team. We do want to be a team, which will allow each and every member to have his voice, and then work tremendously to get the fact data and details so that the board can work in a manner to make good decisions in the best interest of the system. And I think you will see us operate in that accord and in lockstep with our president.
That president is UNC System President Margaret Spellings. Smith offered Spellings and the rest of the board some ideas about his priorities moving forward.
Just some thoughts that I had on the committee structure. You know, when we take a look, we want to have actual challenges and charges at the committee level. So those are things that we actually want to vet and try to accomplish and measure. So one of the things we do want to do, that I want to do, and I think the team wants to do, is measure our success so we know that we are truly moving the system forward. And in that regard, we'll set benchmarks and goals for the committee structure and then work to get there. Some of my ideas that I've talked to each of the chairs about, you know, budget and finance, there's no doubt we want to reinvent the funding model and try to get something that is much more less complicated and much more congruent to where we are as a system today. On that same note, we definitely want to figure out an R&R plan. As I have said many times, and I will continue to say many times,
it has staggered me that we build buildings after buildings, yet we have multi-billion dollar backlog of repair and renovation with no plan. On that accord, we got $33 million this year, which we are thankful to get. But as I told Zito Sartatelli yesterday, I think we can probably paint the buildings for that. And so it's a challenge. And so those are some of the things that we want to shoulder up and work on for long-term solutions.
Smith also referenced other areas of UNC system governance, such as educational planning.
Figure out where we can take a look at non-performing degree programs, degree duplicity, and then efficiencies within that platform, and truly work again with fact, data, and detail, not emotion, and make decisions that are in the best interest of the UNC system.
Smith also referenced goals for the UNC Board's Personnel and Tenure Committee.
One of the things that I want to work on that I'm pretty excited about that I think goes along with data analytics is I do want to develop a performance-based compensation plan for all of our chancellors. And so, you know, one of the challenges we've had in this system is the ability to measure. So, you know, I used to walk around and say, how are we doing there? And we'd say we're doing great, and then we had no quantification for great. And so I think this tool will allow us to start measuring where we have greatness at the school level and where we have challenges that we can help. And along that program, we're going to work hard so that all of our chancellors can participate when they do great things. So we've got some other things that we're working on there. Obviously, we're looking at the search committee process and enhancing that somewhat. And I'm happy to say that we're off to the races there.
You're listening to UNC Board of Governors Chairman Harry Smith discussing his priorities for the board. Another one involves governance of the UNC system's individual campuses.
We are going to do something holistically different there. One of the things that I've learned in this 5 years is that we need to really change the trustee process. And what do I mean by that? We've got to really train them. And so with higher education having the amount of pressure it's got on it, one of the things that myself and a lot of the other members continue to understand is we really never trained the trustees. It's not their fault. It's been a lot of homage. And, you know, we would like to delegate more downstream. And we can do that congruently with a robust training program so that the trustees understand the pressures that the chancellors have, areas that we need to be focused on. And I'm happy to, again, to reference data analytics, because that is the tool that we needed to benchmark and monitor what's truly going on at the campus level. And so we're gonna overhaul that process, and we're also going to overhaul the vetting process and really do a deep dive on the trustee process, including, you know, areas that we may need particular skill sets at each school, whether it be finance, construction. We want to make sure that we, too, have a cross population there that can help the school be successful.
Another area of focus involves public affairs.
We're going to advocate, and we're going to advocate with all the great things we're doing. Part of that will be benchmarking, where we're actually measuring our success. And so we want to be able to take the times we have success, and we want to go over there and show them what value they're getting for their investment. And so the transparency and accountability piece will come into play there, again, as well as data analytics. On the audit team, Jim and his team are working quick, smart, and fast on several fronts. And he also will be focused on transparency and accountability.
The UNC board has a special group focusing on strategic initiatives, led by Alex Mitchell.
I want to make sure that everybody understands Alex has got some great things going on. He's been driving some great initiatives, including summer school, focus on getting our students out in a more affordable, efficient manner. And, it's amazing some of the great things that he has come up with, but excited to have Alex driving some really great stuff.
Harry Smith also wants to increase the board's focus on some schools that have special challenges.
One of the committees I'm terribly excited about is HBCU HMIs. I've told everybody, I've been on this board 5 years. I can't remember a five-minute conversation there. We are going to focus there, and it's a third of our assets. We know that they have challenges nationwide. And so we want to take a look and figure out what we can do to position, you know, those assets for long-term sustainability and long-term success. We will focus on sustainability, advocacy, repositioning those assets and for long-term success. You know, one of the things I've learned early is that all of our schools are important, and they play a pivotal role not only in their geographic markets, but also in the student population that they represent. And congruent with that, I will tell you that a lot of our schools are geographically positioned to help us fight
the rural challenges that we have in the east and the west with the urbanization that we're facing in the state. And so we have to focus there more than ever.
The UNC system plays a major role in North Carolina health care. Smith wants the Board of Governors to examine that role.
We're going to take an approach on that from a system-wide as well and figure out, again, how we can use our health care assets for the citizens of North Carolina. That would be nursing programs, med schools, and hospitals, and again, with an emphasis on how we can utilize assets to help the East and the West. And so, you know, I think we all know that we're facing urbanization not only in the country, but certainly in the state. And I think that we have a key and integral role in helping the East and the West have long-term prosperous success, and we should.
After offering an overview, Smith turned to one particular initiative, a dashboard designed to help board members make decisions.
When I started talking about data analytics, I thought Margaret was going to have a heart attack. We literally were somewhat perplexed at how we didn't have the data that we needed to make decisions. This is not a gotcha tool. This is a help you tool. If you'll take a look at the incredible amount of detail that's going into this tool, but this is also a trend tool. So what are we looking for? Trending up, flat lines, trending down. And so what we want to do is figure out proactively by every school if we think we have an issue early instead of late. And then how can we help with policy, advocacy, resources to help those schools be successful? The other thing that you will see, and some of the schools have already done it, is there, you know, you get to compare how you're doing versus, you know, your peer constituents within the system. So, you know, we've already found some stuff where best practices, and so, you know, I think that you will see there's a big platform here, and this will be an ongoing process that we will continue to redefine and as we move forward.
That's Harry Smith of Greenville, chairman of the UNC System's Board of Governors. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. In the wake of a state audit of the ABC system that found poor contract oversight and wasted money, one state lawmaker is raising the specter of fundamentally reforming North Carolina's antiquated alcohol control system. Carolina Journal's Rick Henderson, who is editor-in-chief, is here with an update on a really fascinating story. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
First of all, help us understand what is different about the way that North Carolina handles the sale and distribution of alcohol than a number of other states.
Okay. North Carolina is one of 17 states that's called a control state, and that is that state government maintains control over at least the distribution to some extent in licensing of all of the spirituous liquors. Now, this is the big distinction between North Carolina and a lot of other states. Some states have total control over alcohol, including beer, wine, and spirits. North Carolina has differing levels of control, but gives the most to spirits. So that would be anything, largely anything with an alcohol content by volume over about 20%. And how our state differs is that if you want to buy something at retail in a liquor product, you have to go to a state ABC store. Those state ABC stores are operated by the state of North Carolina through county ABC boards. And all of the product that's not actually physically in the store is kept at a centralized warehouse in Raleigh. Unlike other states like South Carolina, our neighboring states, South Carolina and Virginia are both called control states. They do that, but they actually allow much more flexibility in the retail sale. And just to give you a quick example of the distinction, this is something Andy Allen at the Retail Merchants Association of North Carolina recently said. The state of North Carolina's pharmacy board controls the licensing of pharmacies and pharmacists. It doesn't sell the drugs. In North Carolina, they license the people who can distribute, who can sell liquor, who can bartend and the like. And they also they control the sale of the product itself. And so North Carolina is in the retail business as well as being in the business of regulation. So that's one of the big distinctions here.
This is one giant bureaucracy.
Yeah, it really is. And it's not only just the state bureaucracy is very small, if you think about it.
But it's the counties.
There are 168 ABC boards in North Carolina's 99 counties, because Graham County is completely dry. So that's the one county that's left that has no alcohol sales at all. But there are 168 boards, and there's no rhyme or reason as to how these boards are set up. For instance, Wake and Mecklenburg County each have one board. Some small counties like Rockingham have three. And these boards are considered to be separate entities of local government. The state has very little oversight over them. They basically oversee themselves. And that's a topic for another segment, but they have been dens of corruption over the years.
Let's talk a little bit about accountability, because recently State Auditor Beth Wood released an audit of the ABC system and found that there was a poor implementation and oversight of a contract. Because you're talking about warehousing and distribution
right here.
So there's a company
yes
that does this for the state. The ABC system is supposed to have oversight over that. The state auditor's audit was really blistering in criticism of that and wasted money. Give us the highlights of that audit.
Yeah, the audit basically found that this company, AB&B, which is based in Durham, I believe, but actually is headquartered in Maryland, handles logistics. It's a logistics company.
This is LB&B, right?
LB&B, I'm sorry, LB&B. Mm-hmm. Yes, LB&B. This is a logistics company. And so what they do is they operate, run, manage the warehouses that contain all the liquor that goes into the state ABC stores. And what the audit found was that because of bad oversight and management of the contract itself, they overcharged taxpayers $11.3 million over about a 10-year period. And moreover, there was about $2 million worth of unused warehouse space that the state was leasing. And essentially what the ABC folks said was, this is warehouse space that we lease to have room to put together holiday packages when the different distillers and distributors put together their packages that have the gift set with the bottles
right
of liquor and the, and the shot glasses and stuff like that. They needed special storage space for this, but the state auditor said, well, maybe it wasn't necessary to rent a warehouse for an entire year if you're only going to use it for 2 months when the warehouses are empty much of the time. So there was some back and forth about that.
Now, all of this has caught the eye, in particular, of one state lawmaker, Representative Chuck McGrady, and he has long been interested in how North Carolina handles the issue of alcohol distribution and sales. But in the wake of this audit, he's had some things to say, and Carolina Journal has been reporting on this. What is his reaction, and what does he want to do?
Representative McGrady, who's from Henderson County, wants to look very seriously at going to a different system, a partial privatization, if you will, of the ABC system, and that is to get the state out of the retail business, essentially. To have the state ABC Commission still in charge of issuing licenses, of making sure through the alcohol law enforcement division to prosecute people who violate licenses, who sell unlicensed liquor, to go after the illegal stills. I mean, to do all the sorts of law enforcement aspects and the regulatory aspects, but then have some other sort of model for retail and distribution. And basically, in other words, get the state out of the warehousing business and get the state out of the retail business, but still have state oversight and control as you have with pharmaceutical products, for instance.
Is there any realistic appetite in the General Assembly for conquering or addressing something like this? I remember this thing has been in place for many, many decades and very entrenched interest groups involved here.
Right. There are very entrenched interest groups. There are a lot of religious groups who think that the state control system is a very good way to suppress alcohol usage. There are the local boards who are very interested in maintaining their little fiefdoms, and so there's that area. There also are there's sort of the propaganda arm, I think, of it, and a lot of that's led by the local boards who basically say, look, we provide an awful lot of tax revenue to the local to the local governments. And we do all these sorts of things, and we make sure that we don't, sell too much merchandise and things like that. We keep good control over things. Then again, I think Representative McGrady's answer is, look, North Carolina charges an excise tax per volume of alcohol sold. It's going to keep charging that tax no matter whether it's sold at a local liquor store or at an ABC store. So it's not as if the tax revenue is going to go away. And also, all of these ABC employees work for local government. So they are getting, they're getting paid by taxpayers. They're providing or providing or not to the state pension system. They're involved in the state health plan. I mean, there are all these other sorts of costs that would go away or would go to the private sector if the state got out of the retail business.
There's already been the departure of one key executive at the ABC Commission, Mr. Hamilton. Did his departure have anything to do with this audit?
The ABC folks aren't talking, but the timing was extremely interesting because July 26, I believe, was the day he departed, and that was also the day that the ABC Commission was given the audit to review and respond, and he left on those circumstances. And then soon after that, Michael Herring, who was a member of the commission itself and had been involved in the ABC at one level or another, was the administrator, was the person who oversaw the day-to-day operations of the agency for some time, he also resigned in the wake of the audit because he said that the ABC and Governor Cooper didn't back up the ABC's position, even though the board itself signed off on the audit and agreed with all the findings.
Lastly, Rick, is Representative McGrady prepared to actually move some sort of legislation on this?
He's likely to start with something probably in the long legislative session, but the other thing that's going on right now is there is a major lawsuit that's going on that's being filed by some of the producers of alcohol in the state who would like to do away with our system of alcohol control entirely. And so as that unfolds, we'll see what happens.
We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief. It's a great story. Again, CarolinaJournal.com. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.